right. John 18. And you know that we're going through the trial of Christ at this time. And we have seen him being examined. When it's all said and done, he will be examined basically six times. And that's not all from a formal standpoint. But you remember he appeared to Annas first because of his connection to the Jews and being the former high priest and having all the clout and power that we have suggested that he continued to have. But he appeared before him. That was more of an unofficial examination, but it was an examination nevertheless. And then he was taken to Caiaphas and finally to the Sanhedrin. And then they led him to Pilate, which would have been the fourth time he was being examined. And then he at some point is sent to Herod and examined and then sent back to Pilate. And so six times he would find himself under investigation. And most of those times, of course, with Annas and Caiaphas, they were just trying to get people to bear false witness and all of that. So their hearts weren't in the right place. But both Herod and Pilate, they were more objective about the situation. They had nothing to gain or lose, basically, from a physical standpoint with regard to Jesus. And they both concluded that he has done nothing wrong. In fact, one of the most amazing things about this context, this part of the Gospels that we read, is how thoroughly that Pilate understood that Jesus was an innocent man. He knew without any question, having examined him, that he was not guilty, was not worthy of death, and that the charges that were brought against him simply could not be substantiated. And we'll see that he tries and tries to get the Jews to understand that, but in the end, obviously, he failed and the Jews prevailed and got what they wanted. But we're right in the midst of that here in John chapter 18. And down at verse 28 or so, it says that they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters, and it was early in the morning, and they themselves did not enter into the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover, and we talked about all of that. And so Pilate went outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered him, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." And the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." And you remember we talked about that. In fact, I made mention at some point Sunday, I can't remember, was it in the Bible study? I can't remember it now, that was technically true. Now, the Jews could put people to death and get away with it, as they did with Stephen, as we all know, and attempted to do on different occasions, with Paul and others. But whenever Rome was involved, then they had to walk very carefully. Because, in other words, if they did something like when they stoned Stephen, Rome would just overlook that. It's not like the Roman authorities didn't know what was going on. They knew everything of what was going on in the kingdom. And so, but they didn't really care. That was just a Jewish thing. And they tried to take a hands-off approach with the Jews because they were so troublesome to them. And so they basically let them do what they wanted with regard to that. But whenever it was a situation when Rome was involved, even in appearance, then Rome had to act. And they certainly would. And so on this occasion, the Jews are bringing a charge against Jesus that was connected with Rome. They were basically saying that Jesus was an insurrectionist by saying that he claimed to be a king and all of that. Then that brings Rome into view. And now, with that on the table, the Jews couldn't just put him to death. And technically, it was never lawful for them ever to put anyone to death. They didn't have that authority. But again, if Rome wasn't really involved, then they could get away with it, as they did with Stephen. But they here, as they bring this charge against Jesus to Pilate, they're bringing this. They want Pilate now to get involved, and so they bring that up. It's not lawful. And at verse 32, it says, and this was fulfilled, or this was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. And I was looking at that, and it's been a couple of months ago, but you remember we talked in quite a bit of detail about the death of Jesus and all of that, and it's puzzling how his disciples really didn't seem to grasp the fact that he was going to die. Like, they just didn't get that. And we said, you know, I mean, Jesus told them on different occasions, but I did make a mistake in that. I did not recall that Jesus had actually told them that he was going to be crucified. And I know that shocks you because my photographic memory, I just didn't remember that. I knew that he told them he was going to be led and condemned by the Gentiles and all of that. But I've since come across passages, and maybe you knew of them already, but Jesus actually told them that they were going to crucify him. You remember over, I think in Matthew chapter 20 is one place in there where he was talking about his death and how he was going to be led and be condemned. See if I can find it real fast. Matthew chapter 20. If you find it before me, let me know. But he's talking to them about verse 18. Go ahead and read that, Sam. And then verse 19. Right. And so now, I remember that first part, but it's the rest. I didn't really realize it. Oh, and chapter 26, I think, is another one. Let's see. Chapter 26. And at verse 2, you know that after, well, it says, verse 1 says, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples, you know that after 2 days, the Passover is coming and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. So that's Jesus. I mean, he's talking to his disciples and tells them that he's going to be crucified. Now, how it is, that makes it even more puzzling, really. It really puts the apostles in worse light, that they didn't understand that he was going to die. They just didn't seem to grasp that. And yet, I'm not sure why. Maybe they just didn't believe him when he was saying that. But when you say you're going to be crucified, what does that, I mean, does anyone survive a crucifixion? No, I mean, they knew. I mean, he's telling them here, I'm going to be condemned by the Gentiles. But what I had forgotten is he actually told them, I'm going to be crucified. And they still had trouble grasping the fact that he was going to die. But I did misspeak those months ago with regard to that. But this idea of him being flogged and mocked and all of that, that plays a part now because that's exactly where we are. In his life, and he's going through that. He is about to be flogged and about to be mocked right now in the things that we study. So all of that is coming to fruition. Again, more evidence that Jesus was the Christ. He knew exactly what was on the horizon and what was coming and gave them details of what was going to transpire. And now we're about to see all of that happen. So verse 32 is just saying, you know, Jesus said all of that. So this was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So verse 33. So Pilate entered the headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered, do you say this of your own accord or did others say it to you about me? Like, where did you hear this? Are you concluding this yourself, that I'm king, or does someone tell you that? And, of course, that kind of perturbed Pilate because he's not involved in Jewish situations at all. He really doesn't care about it. So it says again, Verse 35, Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priest have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" And so he's examining Jesus, investigating and trying to get to the bottom of all of this. And obviously they have accused him of claiming to be king. And so now Pilate is asking him really in a straightforward manner whether or not he is king. And now he begins really to answer that. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not of this world." Now, that says volumes about the kingdom, doesn't it? And right away, in this one passage, premillennialism is proven to be dead wrong. And because the fact of the matter is, if premillennialism is right, then the kingdom Jesus came to establish was a theocratic kingdom, an earthly kingdom that would have had political borders to it. And the king, Jesus being the king, would have reigned in a literal place, that is Jerusalem. And that's what premillennialists believe. He's coming back to reign in Jerusalem to restore the kingdom like it was in the days of David. And that kind of kingdom would be of this world. And so it's not. And that means a couple of things. Basically, not being of this world means the kingdom is not physical in nature. It is spiritual in nature. And that's the only kind of kingdom Jesus ever promised to establish, a spiritual kingdom. Like premillennialists will tell you, you a millennialist, if you would just take the Bible literally, you would be what we are. That's probably right. And they mean that as an insult, as if they're real spiritual and they believe in the Bible more than we do because they take the Bible literally. That's great, except for you're not supposed to take the Bible literally all the time. And I mean, if you're thinking about Bible study, whenever you study the Bible, the first thing you do when you go into any study of any context in the Bible, you do so with the mindset, this is literal. Until you can't. Because there's sometimes you know by certain passages that it has to be either figurative or nonsense. Like the disciples are called sheep. Are they literal sheep? Was Herod a real fox? Was Jesus a door? Or was that just figurative language? So there's places all through the Bible. Paul talks about drinking a cup. When's the last time you drank a cup? Figurative language. You can't understand the Bible unless you understand there's passages in the Bible and a lot of passages that are figurative in nature. So you don't go to the Bible with a mindset, all right, this Bible is just a figurative book and every once in a while there's some literal passages. No, it's the other way around. You go into Bible study believing that it's literal until you realize in your study this has to be figurative. Or not only do we have figures of speech and things of that nature in the Bible, but there's some passages that have to be figurative or it would just be contradictory. It will contradict other passages of Scripture. And so the point is, you interpret the Bible literally until you can't. Until it's obvious that it has to be figurative. So yes, if we took all the passages that deal with the subject matters that the premillennialists want to emphasize, if we took them all literally, we would probably be what they are. Like if we took every sign and symbol in Revelation chapter 20 literally, we'd probably be premillennialist. But that would be a misunderstanding of the Bible and not rightly dividing the Word of God. But that's their idea. Oh, you spiritualize the kingdom. When you say the kingdom is the church, you're spiritualizing it. They emphasize that the kingdom is never the church. Or Israel is never referring to anything other than physical Israel. And whenever you say otherwise, you're spiritualizing things. And that's just your shallow approach to the Bible. Well, sometimes you have to spiritualize things. And when Jesus talked about the kingdom, and now you've heard me say many times before, the kingdom isn't always referring to the church, but sometimes it does. And when it does, then it's letting us know the kingdom is spiritual in nature. Now, even in John chapter 3, in the very beginning, how do you get into the kingdom? Physical birth? Huh? Born again. It's a spiritual birth. Why do we have to be born spiritually to get into the kingdom? Because it's a spiritual kingdom. But all of that is settled right here in John chapter 18 when Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. But he meant a little bit more than just being spiritual. There's no question about that by the language that he uses here. But he's also letting Pilate know that it's spiritual from the standpoint that it doesn't have those political boundaries to it. It's not located in just some specific geographical location that needs to be defended like an earthly kingdom. And that's why he uses this language that he does. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have to do what? Would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. Because that's what you do in worldly, earthly kingdoms. Sometimes you have to fight in order to protect the kingdom and your territory. But Jesus said, that's not the kind of kingdom that I have. It's clearly spiritual in nature. And then he goes on to say, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews, but my kingdom is not from this world. Well, then Pilate says, then Pilate said to him, so, are you a king? just straightforward. Just, are you a king? And now, Jesus doesn't give him quite as straightforward of an answer, but it's not ambiguous at all. He said, Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Now again, you know, you could read this, and it could have been a situation where Pilate just said, are you a king? And Jesus said, yes. And so he didn't say that. But there's no question that he answered in the affirmative, and Pilate knew it. He understood. I was born for this very reason. This was the purpose that I was born. Which again boggles the mind that the premillennialists could come along and say that somehow Jesus didn't do what he came to do. Like, we're talking about something major here. This thing that premillennialists say didn't happen, that is, the establishing of the kingdom, Jesus is now saying, this was the very purpose of my birth. It's why I gave up heaven and took on a flesh and blood body. I was born for this reason. Does that make the kingdom becoming king and therefore establishing a kingdom, does that make that important in God's scheme of things? I was born for this very purpose. And yet that's the very thing that the premillennialists say that he failed to do. Now they really wouldn't say that he wasn't king. But what kind of king are you without a kingdom? They say, oh yeah, he's king. Where's his kingdom? It's not here yet. What kind of king? You can't be a king if you don't have a kingdom. And so in denying that he has a kingdom and that his kingdom has been postponed, they if they're going to be consistent, they have to say his kingship has been postponed too. Or else it's just nonsense. And yet that's their position. The kingdom has been postponed. He's not king yet. He's not reigning on David's throne yet. Yet Acts chapter 2 tells us he's on his throne right now. But it's not an earthly throne. It's a heavenly throne. He's at the right hand of God. His kingdom has been established. It's just not of this world. But the point of it is, this was the very purpose of him coming. A central part of his mission and his plan and God's plan of salvation. And so, I'm sorry, Matt, I saw your hand and then I... Oh, okay. Yeah, good. Yes. That would be, yeah, that would be a more of a direct response, wouldn't it? Yeah. So it's not unclear anyway. He clearly is answering in the affirmative, but that would be good. So, but there's no question. He is king. And so that was the reason that he came. All right. Well, Pilate, he kind of answers that in an interesting way. He just said to him, "What is truth?" And that was kind of in response to that statement that Jesus made that he was born not only to become king, but he said to bear witness to the truth. And everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. And then so Pilate says, "What is truth?" And that's not a sincere searching for truth at all. I mean, he didn't care. It's really sarcastic. Like, it's really, if we were saying, we'd say like, "What is truth anyway? Like, well, you know, can you really know truth? Is there any such thing as absolute truth? What is truth?" And you know, there's a lot of people in the world today who don't really believe that there's any absolute truth. That to a lot of people, even religiously, truth is subjective, and it basically determined by your own view of things. There's nothing concrete. And yet the Bible clearly teaches there is such a thing as absolute truth. And that is, of course, the Word of God. Jesus said, if you know the truth will set you free. And so, but, you know, this kind of gives a quick view of Pilate's attitude, his philosophy in life. You know, what is truth anyway? Is there any real truth? And so he seems to deny that a little bit. But it goes on to say, and after he had said this, he went back outside to the Jews and he told them. Now, here's the key conclusion with Pilate. I find no fault in him. So did he understand exactly the nature of the kingdom that Jesus would establish? No, it's not likely. But he knew one thing. Jesus was not going to be the kind of king, that would rival the emperor. So it couldn't be a physical king. It couldn't be the kind of kingdom that premillennialists think. And not only the premillennialists, but the Jews, even his apostles. You remember, were thinking that Jesus was coming to set up a physical kingdom and restore it like it was in the days of David. But clearly that's not the case. And if Pilate thought that for a minute, if he thought that Jesus was going to be a king over a physical earthly kingdom, he would have found him guilty right away. Or else his own life would have been in danger. Jesus would have to die, and not only Jesus, but every individual who ever followed Jesus or was connected to Jesus in any way would have to be put to death. This would be an insurrection. But Pilate didn't conclude any of that, did he? He goes back out and says, I haven't found anything. I've questioned him. I asked him straight out, are you a king? He gave me a pretty straight answer, according to the New King James Version, you rightly said. And he goes right back out and says, I find no guilt in him at all. And so again, that says volumes about that. Yeah. Of Jesus? Yes. Yes. Probably not. but yeah, he was afraid. There's no question as we go through this that Pilate was doing everything he could to convince them that he was innocent. But it was self-preservation, not from the standpoint of Jesus. He wasn't afraid of Jesus. But he was afraid. See, what was about to happen was these Jews were about to riot over this. And what he was really afraid of was causing an uproar or allowing an uproar to be caused, or even the Jews going back to the emperor because they had done it before and complained about him. He has been such a brutal leader and has caused, killed people, all kinds of things, and they have complained about what he has done to where he has been threatened already. You're going to be removed. And that's what he's afraid of. And he's sort of, in a difficult, precarious situation because those Jews were hard to deal with. And I'm not, if this was on TV or something, I'd get blasted for that. People think I'm anti-Jew and I'd be in all kind of trouble. It's not that at all. They were just a difficult people to deal with because they believed what they did so strongly. They disliked being under Roman yoke to such an extent they were willing to die over it. And they just caused problem after problem after problem. And it was easier for Rome just to give them a little space. Rome could have and ultimately did attack them, of course, AD 70 and all of that, and put them down. But it was just easier for them to say, all right, you can observe your own law, which the Romans did with all of the people who were subject to them. But with the Jews, they kind of gave them a longer leash. At least it seems. And because they were so difficult, but they would go to the emperor and complain, and Pilate was real close to being removed. And I think I told you last week, he went through all of this, and shortly after all of this happened, he was removed from office anyway. The Romans had enough with him, and he ended up committing suicide because of it. But that had none of that had happened yet. In his mind, he's still firmly in power, but he knows, it could slip at any time. Those Jews go back and complain. Or if this spins out of control and there's a riot, then, Rome would have enough. Okay, you're just not competent. And so that's what he's afraid of. So. Well, because he didn't believe. He wasn't guilty of what they were charging him with. He didn't, for whatever reason, he did not conclude that Jesus was claiming to be a physical king on earth. He believed that part of it. Because again, if he thought that for a minute, he'd have to act. He could not just go back out there and say he's not guilty. So that's what he did believe that part. Whether or not he believed Jesus was the Messiah, not likely at all. But he knew he wasn't claiming to be an earthly king. And so that's the thing that's important to us today with regard to all the false teaching with reference to that. All right. So he says, but you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? And they cried out again, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. Now, what's interesting here in James, in John, it says, but you have a custom. The other gospels make it sound a lot more like this custom wasn't really a Jewish custom at all. It was a custom that Pilate had, that he was really behind all of that. And we don't have any record outside of the Gospels of this particular custom. And so it does seem like it was more Pilate. Again, he did everything he could to appease the Jews. And what we find in all of this, that one of the reasons there was a couple of reasons why he kept going back out and he was really trying to get them to release Jesus. It wasn't because of his sincerity towards justice. It was, number one, in Matthew's account, we find that He felt like they were just bringing all of this up about Jesus because they were envious. And because of that, they thought, particularly with what we're reading now, that when he holds up before the people this Barnabas next to an innocent man, they clearly see which one should be released. Because they're just doing all this because they're envious. And that's only going to take you so far. At the end of the day, you'll give that up. And do the right thing. Of course, he was greatly wrong about that. But not only that, if you read Matthew's account, somewhere right in here, while he was on the judgment seat, is when he got word from his wife that she tells him, I had a dream. And so he said, you don't do anything with this righteous man, because in a dream she was told that he was innocent. So, you know, that plays a part in all of that. So he desperately wants the Jews to reconsider, but it's not because of any justice at all. It's because of these other factors. And so, but now here's the choice that the people have, Barabbas or Jesus. And it's really an interesting situation. That, I mean, Barabbas, again, he's called a robber here. But, and I think it, maybe Mark's account, I can't remember which of the Gospels, he was charged with insurrection. Which is kind of ironic, isn't it? That they're trumping up charges against Jesus for being an insurrectionist. And then now all of a sudden it comes about that they have an opportunity to choose to have a real insurrectionist released. And, of course, they wanted him released because, I mean, after all, if you stop and think about it, and this must have been a red flag for Pilate even, why would the Jews care about an insurrectionist anyway? This fellow Barabbas would have been an insurrectionist against Rome. And so the Jews wouldn't care about that. They wouldn't want to be associated with him because that would get them in trouble. But, you know, behind the scenes, they'd be saying, go at it. We hope you succeed. You know, as someone rising up against Rome, trying to overthrow the emperor, well, you have at that. So, of course, they wanted him released. They didn't care about that at all. But what we also learn is he was a murderer. So he was an insurrectionist and he was a murderer. Now, he probably killed some Romans. That's why he's on death row over here. He probably killed some Romans in his attempt to overthrow the power. But listen to me, I don't care why he did it. Like, if it's me and I'm thinking about a person who's going to be set free and be roaming the streets with my wife and my children, I don't want that violent man on the streets. Yet they're so blinded to this, they want Jesus put to death so badly that they said, no, give us Barabbas. Give us Barabbas. We want Barabbas to be released. They have a decision. It's interesting that the name Barabbas literally means son of father. In fact, history tells us that his full name was Jesus Barabbas. Now, you think about that. So now they have a choice to make. Who are you going to let go? Jesus Barabbas or Jesus the Christ? They have a real choice. They have a decision. And obviously, they made the wrong decision. They want Barabbas to be set free. That's their choice. And so Pilate, again, he's disappointed in all of that. He thought for sure they would see this situation and they would obviously choose to let Jesus go and he'd be done with this whole thing. But no, they don't want that. They cried out again, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. And then we get right into verse 19. It says, and then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And that's when you really see. Now, really, I was about to say, you really see just what a terrible person he was. And there's no doubt about it. But he has him flogged here. He has him scorched because it's kind of a last desperate attempt for the Jews to see him. He's going to bring him back out after he's flogged. And we don't have time now, but you've heard sermons on flogging and all of that. I mean, it's brutal. I mean, it leaves the person in a bloody mess the way they typically did it. And there's no real reason to think they didn't do it to Jesus the same way they did it to everybody else. But a flogging would literally rip the skin right off your back. Your back would just be just tore up. In fact, most people would pass out during a flogging. It was so brutal. They bend you over, take all your clothes off and bend you over, and they put little bits of bones and stone in the end of the whip, and you'd be bent over so your skin would be stretched, and usually with the first whip, it would rip open your skin. And with every whip, it would be more bloody and more bloody, just a painful thing. And you stop and think, that happened to your Savior. That's what Jesus went through. And he knew it before it happened. He knew it was coming. And he still did it. But that's what he went through. And Pilate arranged, he ordered that, knowing that Jesus was an innocent man. Now, what he's hoping is, afterwards, he'll bring this man out. He's broken. He's bloody. Surely they'll see that and say, all right, that's enough. We got him enough. But that didn't work either. But think about someone in power knowing that he's innocent and then saying, I know you didn't do anything wrong. He tells them, yeah, you're not guilty of anything, but go flog him. What kind of man is Pilate? And that's what happened to Jesus. And verse 1 simply says, then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And we'll see more. Whenever we continue with this, we'll see more of that and how he was mistreated by the soldiers and all of that. Jesus went through it. And this is the worst part up until the crucifixion, of course, of Jesus' life on earth and what he had to endure. So we'll deal with that next time.